You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During last year's presidential campaign, Sarah Palin bragged about the role she'd played in creating what she called the largest private sector infrastructure project in North American history, a $40 billion natural gas pipeline. But despite what she said on the campaign trail, no work had been done to build the pipeline, and it's not clear that the project will ever get built. In an article in this month's Condé Nast portfolio, Joe McGinnis argues that it's Governor Palin herself who has been the biggest obstacle in preventing the project from getting off the ground. Mr. McGinnis joins me now to talk about his piece called Pipe Dreams. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
You quote several occasions during the presidential campaign when Governor Palin took credit for the pipeline project. Why do you think she bragged about something that doesn't even exist?
Well, it sounded good at the time. Become something of a pattern for her, that she will say something that pops into her mind because she thinks she's going to get a good reaction from the audience she's speaking to at that moment, and then later her people have to come along and try to tidy things up and say, well, she didn't really mean to say that, and the governor didn't intend this. With the pipeline, she was taking advantage of the fact that everybody's in favor of a natural gas pipeline. There's not a lot of environmental concern, which is, makes it different from drilling up in the wildlife refuge. The gas pipeline is a win-win-win situation for everyone. The reason that it hasn't been built is because it's too expensive, it's too difficult, and there's no way for the companies that own the natural gas to control the gas to make any profit from building it. And Palin's administration has refused to discuss the financial structure of the pipeline deal she's putting forward. So she's come to power up there as something of a populist, and that's the way she appeals to people across America. But even populists have to have workable programs, and the pipeline, she's just all show and no go, I think is the way I would put it.
Well, she's listed the project as one of her biggest priorities, but you're right that she's the biggest obstacle in preventing the construction of the pipeline. Do you think that
there's a simple thing here. The gas that would have to go into a pipeline, the natural gas, is controlled by the same three oil companies. That's BP, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips, the same three who control the oil at Prudhoe Bay. The gas is located just right down below the ground where the oil is. It's their gas. And to freeze them out of the process, to show that she's not a servant of big oil, which is a fair enough sentiment. That's, we could all agree that we shouldn't be servants of big oil. But she went ahead and made a deal with a Canadian company, TransCanada, a pipeline building company that has no access to the natural gas. So she's pledged up to $500 million of Alaskan tax money to TransCanada in matching funds as they go forward with their pipeline project, but they're not going to ever have any gas to put in the line.
You characterize Big Oil's past relationship with Alaska as that of a colonial master. So was this her way of declaring her independence from it? And can you really get away from Big Oil in Alaska?
Well, you can't get away from it, and they don't want to get away from it. But I think it's true that over the past 40 years, the oil companies have exploited Alaska to a great degree capitulation of the Alaska state legislature. The Ted Stevens verdict was just thrown out for prosecutorial misconduct, but that same FBI investigation that led to the indictment of Stevens has also led to the indictment, trial, and imprisonment of 10% of Alaska state legislature. And the crime there was accepting bribes from people close to the oil companies. The tax structure in Alaska is the most important issue because oil profits put 90% of the money that Alaska receives each year is from tax. taxes on oil companies. So the rate at which the oil is taxed is a tremendously volatile issue. Now, the rate at which the natural gas would be taxed as it went into the pipeline is an equally volatile issue. And Palin's position has been, for the past 2 years since she's been in office, that she will not even discuss with the oil companies the rate at which she would propose to tax the natural gas, or even the means by which that rate would be calculated.
You're right that Governor Palin has built a career out of puffing up dragons she could then slay. How does that apply here?
Well, the oil companies, of course, are the most formidable dragons on the horizon in Alaska, especially since it's just been just a little over 20 years now since the Exxon Valdez oil spill that devastated Prince William Sound. That area has never come back all the way from that. That really turned Alaskans against big oil, and it became a good thing for a politician to do, to be able to show that he or she was going to stand up to big oil, to not be a colonial slave to this imperial master. And Palin used that as one of the planks on the program that she led her to the governorship. But she's finding, as have other governors before her, that it's one thing to talk that game, but it's much more difficult to play it because, let's face it, Exxon can hire better lawyers than the state of Alaska can.
Now, you said that everybody seems to want this. Alaskan politicians try to implement the pipeline idea long before Palin came to power. And that's because this is, we would gain a lot of benefits from it. Don't we have a lot of natural gas in the contiguous 48 states? How big is the natural gas resource up in Alaska?
Well, it's enormous. And, natural gas, it depends where we are in America. There's up here in New England, where I live, there's simply no natural gas. That's not an option for energy use.
And would that pipeline ease the situation in New England?
I don't think it would, because you'd have to build a pipe to carry it all the way to New England. And that gets...
That would be truly trans-Canada.
Right now, more of the pipeline would go through Canada, and the gas would come out at a terminal in Alberta. And then, pipe already exists that could carry it as far away as Louisiana. This is a 20 to 25-year supply of gas that could... could certainly be a big step. It's pretty hard to quantify until you actually get the thing built and see the rate of flow, et cetera. But this would be a significant step along the path to energy independence. And this is the path that everybody can agree we want to be on. Barack Obama, President Obama, has made the construction of the pipeline a high priority. But George Bush before him had done the same thing. The problem is it's going to cost $40 billion to construct the pipeline across that terrain. And the companies that have the gas are not going to pledge the gas to that line unless they can be sure that the sale of it will bring them profit. Because once again, in our capitalist system, the corporations are responsible to their shareholders, and they're not responsible to the citizens of Alaska.
My guest is Joe McGinnis, whose article Pipe Dreams appears in the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio. Well, Governor Palin's pipeline plan is the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, the AGIA, which provides a $500 million stipend to the company that builds the line, and no American company ended up bidding on the contract. What discouraged them from even bidding on the deal?
Provisions were so restrictive. The Gas Line Inducement Act required the company that would receive the contract from Alaska to go forward with the process of trying to obtain regulatory approval for the line, even in the absence of a commitment of natural gas. In other words, TransCanada, next year they have what's called open season. That's in the gas business. That means that anybody with gas can come up and say, we will commit our gas to your pipeline under the following terms. Now, because Palin has made the terms impossible for the oil companies to live with, no one's going to commit gas to the pipeline project for TransCanada the next year. But the Gasline Act requires TransCanada, nonetheless, to spend hundreds of millions of dollars putting together the proposal and sending it to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington to get U.S. federal approval for the line. In the end, the decision on whether to build it or not is going to be made in Washington. It's not going to be made in Juneau or Anchorage or Calgary or Houston, Texas. So it's a situation where other companies took a long look at it. Warren Buffett took a long look at the situation, and his decision, I'm told, not to get involved was simply because Alaska politics seemed so corrupt, he had no way of telling what would happen over the next 20 years.
So was TransCanada the only company that even bid on the pipeline contract?
They were the only company whose bid was deemed acceptable by the state of Alaska. There was a Chinese concern made a bid. There were a couple of small bids from independent companies that didn't really have the resources. And there's been a lot of back and forth, I have to tell you, Leonard, a lot of back and forth between the Palin administration and TransCanada executive ranks. One of the architects of this pipeline project had been a lobbyist for TransCanada before joining the Palin administration. So it was a lot of pretty cozy backroom stuff, which is exactly what Sarah Palin came to office promising to put an end to.
TransCanada CEO recently said, I don't know whether we're going to see this get built or not. So even he has doubts. Does TransCanada control any natural gas?
No. TransCanada controls nothing. What they do is they build pipelines, and they apparently do it fairly well. They haven't had any problems that I'm aware of.
So they seem ideal for this. Is the real problem TransCanada? Is it Governor Palin? Is it the oil companies? What about the Alaskan legislature? Do they support Governor Palin's plan, the AGIA?
Well, they did pass it. It received approval by the legislature in last summer, July of 2008. But a lot has come to the surface. And in fact, a lot came to the surface only with the publication of my article in Portfolio that that Alaskans hadn't been aware of before. I think if you were to put this to a vote next week in the legislature, you'd find that it would probably not pass. I think enough people have changed their views as they've learned more about it. Palin's people did a good job of selling it last summer. Then, of course, she went off for her national bit of fame, and now she's back, and people looked at her with slightly, they look askance a bit more than they did before, because now she's being perceived as a partisan right-wing Republican figure, where before, up until she was chosen by McCain, she was able to portray herself as really a down-the-middle person who's above party politics and only cares about the best interests of Alaskans. The perception is changing rapidly.
Do you think the press dropped the ball when they didn't look into the claims she was making during the campaign?
I do. I think they were so busy looking at her wardrobe and her family situation that her position on issues and the positions that she had taken in Alaska rather than just talked about would really have opened a lot of eyes. But it's, you know, natural gas is not an inherently sexy subject to talk about. You know, I appreciate that you're doing it, but your audience here is a little bit different from the mass audience, say, that tunes into Fox News. Greta Van Susteren wouldn't want to have a 30-minute conversation about natural gas. So,
although you do have a picture of her talking to Sarah Palin with the article.
That's right, but I bet they weren't talking about the pipeline. they're probably talking about Greta's husband's role in in Sarah Palin's political action committee that has been recently formed, but I think that's probably a topic for another day.
Joe McGinnis's article, Pipe Dreams, is the cover story of the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine, the April 2009 issue. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, the story of two men who battled against great odds for 30 years to protect children from lead and getting it removed from a wide array of household products. Plus, with Passover starting tonight, we'll find out how matzah is made. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
The chant is, drill, baby, drill. And that's what we hear all across this country in our rallies, because people are so hungry for those domestic sources of energy to be tapped into. They know that even in my own energy-producing state, we have billions of barrels of oil and hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of clean, green natural gas. And we're building a nearly $40 billion natural gas pipeline, which is North America's largest and most expensive infrastructure project ever.
That was Sarah Palin during the 2008 vice presidential debate talking about the $40 billion natural gas pipeline that may never be built, the subject of an article by Joe McGinnis called Pipe Dreams in the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio. So, Joe, let's get back to those big oil companies. After the AGIA bill was enacted, BP and ConocoPhillips launched their own project, Denali, the Alaska gas pipeline. How is the Denali pipeline different from the AGIA proposal?
Well, the Denali project, which is, as you say, launched by BP and Conoco, it's different simply because that one, when that pipeline is built, there will be gas to put into it. BP and Conoco obviously would put their natural gas into the pipeline that they have built, not into a competing pipeline. And Exxon, which has not committed itself either way, obviously is not going to accept the restrictions placed on the companies by the AGIA project. So in the end, you can be pretty sure that Exxon's gas would go into the competing pipeline.
Although they didn't invest in it.
They're not going to build two pipelines. So what's happening now is there's a lot of posturing going on, and it's very expensive posturing. These companies are going out there doing surveys. There's so much duplication of effort that what was a $40 billion project is likely to wind up being an $80 billion project. And when it gets to that level, people are going to look at it and say, you know what, it's too expensive, we just can't do it. The former governor, Tony Knowles, who I spoke to when I was out there recently in Anchorage, he put it very succinctly. He said, for Sarah Palin, getting the pipeline built is only her second highest priority. Her highest priority is making sure the oil companies don't build it.
Now, Exxon Mobil, which is the world's biggest gas company, decided not to invest in Denali. Doesn't that make it more difficult to create that pipeline?
Well, it would be if they, in the end, refused to commit their gas to it. So
you think this pipeline is going to be built?
I think there's a better chance that the Denali line will be built than there is that the Trans-Canada line will be built. What I think is likely to happen is at some point they're going to have to sit down and compromise. That at some point, the biggest issue has been the rate at which the gas would be taxed. The three companies, Exxon, Conoco, and BP, say, look, this is going to go on for 25 years. This gas will flow through the pipeline for 25 years. We want to know how much you're going to be taxing our rate of profit. And Palin's administration has said, no, we're not going to tell you that. You're just going to have to. We're going to decide, and we can change it. We can change the rate, and we can change the mechanism by which the rate is calculated at any point during the life of the project. And you're simply going to have nothing to say about that. Well, if if someone offers you a job and they say, we'll pay you a salary of $100,000, would you like the job? You would tend to say yes, but then if they say, oh, by the way, you're going to have to pay $99,500 in income tax, the job suddenly isn't quite so appealing. You'd like to know what the tax structure will be before you commit tens of billions of dollars to a project.
Well, TransCanada seems to have a different idea. Its CEO has said that the single most important step in moving forward would be to have fruitful discussions with the producers, the other oil companies. So he's taking a different tack than Governor Palin.
He needs to have fruitful discussions because TransCanada needs to have access to the gas. TransCanada is perfectly willing to negotiate terms with the oil companies. They've been eager to do this all along, but, and this is the key point, the provisions of the AGIA Act, the Gasline Inducement Act, prevent them from doing so. Only the state of Alaska can bring these parties together, and Palin so far has shown no inclination to even try. It wasn't until this article came out this month that Palin held a press conference in Alaska to say that, well, maybe on second thought she would consider discussing tax rates with the oil companies, which was a complete reversal of the position she'd adhered to for the 2 years leading up to this.
Although Governor Palin's camp, issued a challenge to you to show one shred of proof that she's ignored the pipeline issue since returning to Alaska.
Well, go back and play what she said during that debate, Leonard, where she said we're building this $40 billion pipeline, and I'd like the state of Alaska to provide one shred of proof that is being built, because it simply isn't there. And as time passes and priorities change, the likelihood that it will ever be built may be diminishing. You know, a lot depends on the price of natural gas, which is measured by the trillions of cubic feet. And it's about one-third of what it was at its peak last summer. It's fallen along with oil prices. And a whole lot of the profit motive for undertaking this arduous and technically challenging task of building a pipeline in the Arctic, a lot of the incentive goes away when the price of natural gas drops back to where it is today.
What happens to the $500 million that Alaska gave to TransCanada?
They are giving it in installments. It's essentially matching funds. For every dollar TransCanada spends on developing this project, Alaska reimburses them 50 cents, up to $500 million. But there's another provision in that contract which is causing more concern among Alaskans today, and that is the damages clause. Alaska would have to pay triple the amount, which would be $1.5 billion in damages to TransCanada, if they were to proceed independently of TransCanada in negotiating with oil companies. She's really boxed the state into, she's painted herself and her whole big state into a very small corner. There's very little room for her to maneuver, and she's basically done what she said she didn't want to do, which is to make Alaskans once again to leave them at the mercies of big oil.
My guest is Joe McGinnis. His article, Pipe Dreams, is in the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. And this is WNYC. Forgot to mention that. WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Two Republican legislators who oppose TransCanada's state license have introduced a resolution seeking a reevaluation of the AGIA decision in light of the new economic conditions. What could a reevaluation mean for this project?
Well, a reevaluation could mean that they would put a freeze on the payments to TransCanada, which would trigger litigation, but whereby TransCanada would sue the state of Alaska, and we'd wind up with a bigger and more horrendous mess in which only the lawyers would profit. Once you sign the contract, as they did, and there was a huge ceremony last December in Fairbanks when Governor Palin and the head of the CEO of TransCanada got together, and she handed basically the keys to the pipeline to TransCanada and opened up the checkbook to $500 million. Once you've done that, can you then the next year turn around a different legislature and says, no, we don't like that deal, so we're going to cancel it? Well, you know, that makes the state of Alaska seem like it's not a very good business partner if you can't rely on a written contract. So,
but it sounds,
I think the reevaluation was intended to show that sentiment has shifted, that there are people who want to get onto the other side now, so when they run for reelection, they'll be able to say, yeah, you know, it's like the Iraq War. I voted for it at the time, but then I came to realize it was a terrible mistake.
So there's really a revolt by members of her own party.
Absolutely.
Now, Governor Palin has also called for an in-state bullet line to deliver North Slope natural gas to urban Alaska markets. Do you think that stands any chance of being built?
Yeah, sure, that stands a chance of being built. That's a completely separate project that doesn't require federal regulatory approval. It's an in-state situation. They call it a bullet line because it's a smaller diameter pipe. It's a much smaller scale project. But even that is costly, and if the state wants to involve itself in this private enterprise, the state's going to have to structure the deal in such a way as to make somebody want to build the pipeline. People aren't going to go out and start building pipelines. It's a huge project, you know, ordering steel, you know, digging up the ground. Ground is frozen like that. It's tough. So it's a lot easier to talk about it than it is to do it.
Now, you write that after the presidential campaign, Governor Palin had returned to Alaska feeling she'd outgrown it. Is that one of the problems that she's also having to contend with, that people have sensed that in her?
Well, I think so. I think looking at her behavior during this current legislative session, she's showing every sign of considering herself now a national political figure first and the governor of Alaska only second. She's up for reelection in 2010. There's a growing feeling among Alaskans who I've talked to that she will not seek reelection, that she will finish as a one-term governor, and that she would then like to move on to find some sort of national forum, you know, maybe on Fox News, probably not on WNYC, but somewhere where she can begin her full-scale campaign for the presidency in 2012. Here in the Northeast, the thought of Palin as a serious presidential candidate in 2012 is kind of laughable, but there are large parts of the country where that's taken very seriously. So she has tasted life in the big time, and she doesn't like sitting in the dark out there 5,000 miles away from everything.
Hasn't your article drawn a lot of fire from conservatives? What are they accusing you of?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, Palin's always been opposed by conservatives in Alaska. This is one of the mysteries, how she is perceived as a candidate of the far right, when in Alaska, the opposition to her and her policies has mostly come from the conservative members of the Republican Party. There are radio talk show hosts at Anchorage who go on the air every day calling her a socialist. She's meddling in private enterprise. This gas line project is a prime example where she's getting the state involved in business in a way that's considered inappropriate by conservatives. So her support for this pipeline project came from Democrats in the legislature. More Republicans opposed it than Democrats. So it's sort of a reverse image kind of thing, where the view of her from outside Alaska is diametrically opposed to what Alaskans see and how they consider her.
A listener, Bill from Manhattan, asks if you aren't carrying the water for big oil. What other politician would you criticize for attacking big oil? He writes, and it seems Governor Palin won't agree to setting long-term tax rates for this. Isn't that like most politicians? Patterson also has said something similar in New York State, this person writes.
Well, I'm not familiar with the situation in New York State, but it's just a matter of common sense that a company that controls natural gas is not going to commit that natural gas to a project if they don't understand what the financial terms are going to be. Actually, the last thing in the world I would ever do is carry water for big oil. The book I wrote about Alaska that was published back in way back in the 20th century, going to extremes, made it very clear that I feel the oil companies have essentially raped and pillaged Alaska, and I think that Palin's initial motivation, wanting to control the degree of power they would exercise, that was sensible. That was well-intentioned. It's just that she gets in over her head when the waters are still very shallow. She just doesn't have a grasp of policy or of the implications of the policies that she advocates. And when she finds that life gets more complicated than she'd like it to be, she's so far shown herself unable to cope with that.
You made several attempts to interview her, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And her people, this is going way back to November, they said that she wouldn't even pose for a picture for portfolio unless they could see the article in advance to be sure that it would be favorable.
Well, you have a nice picture of her standing out in the snow, and you have lots of pictures of her with other people, ranging from Mike Ditka to Jesse Jackson, Hank Williams Jr., and Henry Kissinger. So were they all just available to you?
Those were, yeah, the portfolio art and photography department put those together, but the pictures taken, the cover picture of her standing in her parka on the icy with the snow all around her, that was done actually for a photo shoot for Vogue magazine just about a year ago.
Also owned by Condé Nast?
Owned by Condé Nast. So mm-hmm. Portfolio just walked down the halls of Vogue and got those pictures. And the other ones were all pictures in the public domain. She, as I say, she would not speak to me or even stand silently and pose for a picture unless she could be assured that the coverage would be favorable. That's the kind of policy that she's adopted with the press in Alaska, and it had proven quite successful up there. But on the national level, you know, I think we play by different standards.
But you did say that less than 24 hours after the article came out, she called a press conference, and it was to announce that she was reversing her policy against sharing tax information with the oil companies?
It was to announce that she was going to reconsider that policy.
Just to reconsider
it. She didn't come out and say, this is our, she also called a press conference to denounce the article, saying that it was a hit piece, and to which I responded, yes, and it's a hit piece in that it hit the bullseye, and really pointed out what she had been trying to obfuscate for the past 6 months, that she's committed the state of Alaska to a deal that simply cannot work.
Well, Governor Palin says the pipeline is going to be built. President Obama wants it to be built. The Alaskan legislature wants it to be built. The CEO of TransCanada doubts that it will be built. So what's your opinion?
My opinion is that within the next 2 years, cooler heads will prevail, and TransCanada will begin to negotiate with the oil companies that control the natural gas, and that that it's likely that they will finally come to terms, but by the time they do, you know, by the time they do, the cost might have gone from 40 to 60 to 80. You know, it depends on so many things. What's the price of steel going to be in 2 years? The construction would not start for several years, no matter what. I said I don't think you're going to see this gas pipeline built in my lifetime. Well, I'm older than Governor Palin, but I don't think, Larry, that we're going to see this pipeline built in her lifetime either.
Now, is the pipeline that we're talking about, the Aegea pipeline, taking the same route as the Denali pipeline that ConocoPhillips and BP are proposing?
Yes, through the state of Alaska, yes. Eventually, they would probably come out at different terminals in Canada, or it could possibly go straight into Green Bay, Wisconsin, or even Chicago. But more or less, those are parallel routes. There's not a lot of option in terms of routes because of the terrain.
Just one more thing, Joe, on another subject. You wrote a book about staying in the Abruzzi area in Italy, covering a soccer team. Isn't that the area that's just been hit by this earthquake?
Yes, it is, Leonard. The town that I was in and wrote about, Castel di Sangro, is actually about 50 miles south of L'Aquila, where the worst of the damage was. And I just had reports from friends overnight saying that there was damage to buildings in Castel di Sangro, but nothing had totally collapsed and there had been no loss of life.
Had you heard about the possibility of earthquakes? I've never really thought of Italy as a place of earthquakes. Volcanoes, yes, Pompeii,
well,
for example.
Yeah, actually, there have been a lot more earthquakes since the days of Vesuvius. There have been more earthquakes than volcanoes. Italy is very earthquake prone, and this is not the first in recent years that has caused massive loss of property and even loss of life. Italy is very susceptible to earthquakes. I think it's sort of like Southern California in that respect.
So that means it's on a fault line.
Yes, it is.
Well, thank you for talking about fault lines. There is one that runs through Alaska as well. And I want to thank you so much for talking about it with us, Joe McGinnis, whose article, Pipe Dreams, subtitled Forget Drill, Baby Drill. Sarah Palin says she's building a $40 billion gas pipeline, which even President Obama wants. The only problem is it isn't there, and it's her fault. It's in the current issue, the April issue of Condé Nast Portfolio. My great pleasure speaking with you, Joe McGinnis.
I enjoyed it, Leonard. Thank you.
Up next, with Passover starting tonight, we find out how matzah is made from Aaron Gross, the co-owner of Streit's. He is in the fifth generation of the family to run the business on the Lower East Side. And I'd like to invite you to attend our next free projection screening. It's on Tuesday, April 14th, when we will be showing the Depression-era musical Gold Diggers of 1993, featuring dance numbers by Busby Berkeley, at the Galapagos Art Space in Brooklyn. Seating is limited. For more information and to RSVP, visit our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.